It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. David Bedford is an apple breeder. He's the man behind superstars like the Honeycrisp, Zestar, and Sweet Tango. But the apple wasn't always his favorite fruit.
My career was almost derailed by a single apple, and that was Red Delicious. I was raised on Red Delicious and sort of lost interest in apples because of that. And yes, it is a beautiful apple, but the flavor was really not that much. So I came into it thinking that apples were good for you, but not that excited about it. And somewhere along the line, I became exposed to the range of apple flavors and textures. So I found a good home here at the University of Minnesota, where our purpose is to make apples exciting to eat.
What it takes to create a great apple, and a whole lot more, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. David Bedford is an apple breeder. And while you probably don't know him by name, you've probably tasted his apples. David and his team at the University of Minnesota are apple superstars, responsible for explosively crisp, crunchy, sweet, and flavorful apples like the Game Changers, the Honeycrisp, the Zestar, the Snow Sweet, and the Sweet Tango. And David isn't slowing down. His team plans to release a brand new apple sometime next year. Well, David took some time away from the orchard and joined me in the studios at American Public Media. David, it's great to have you back.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Now, you developed the Honeycrisp, worked with the team that developed the Honeycrisp. But what were some of the other apples that you've worked with?
Well, certainly Honeycrisp was our best-known release,
right.
but we have a few newer ones, too. Zestar, Snow Sweet are two of the ones that have come out since the Honeycrisp.
Yeah, and those are in the stores now.
That's right, yeah. But probably our best-known child of Honeycrisp, if we would say it that way, would be Sweet Tango. And then I also brought another one today that's a brand-new release that we haven't even talked about yet.
Okay. I'm thinking about how taste has changed, that now we seem to like sweetness. I'm thinking, you know, our wines are sweeter, but also bold flavors and spice and crunch and salt. Does any of that affect how you think out the development of a new apple?
Well, I think it does. I mean, if I go back to my childhood, my career was almost derailed by a single apple, and that was Red Delicious. I was raised on Red Delicious and sort of lost interest in apples because of that. And yes, it is and was a beautiful apple, but the flavor was really not that much. So I came into it thinking that apples were good for you. I'm sure they are, but not that excited about it. And somewhere along the line, I became exposed to the range of apple flavors and tastes and textures that we hadn't seen. And so I fell in love with it. And so I found a good home here at the University of Minnesota, where our purpose is to make apples exciting to eat.
Do you remember what was the apple that was the aha moment for you?
Well, I think the one that I remember the best certainly was Honeycrisp. That was so different when I first tasted it. I was a young man just out of grad school, and I didn't know the whole range of apples and what was possible. But when I tasted Honeycrisp, it sort of reset my brain as to what was possible. And it was so good, I wasn't even sure what it was. It was a totally unexpected experience.
The thing about a Honeycrisp I think that's so interesting is the crispness.
Yes.
But also, it's not just sweet. It has so much going on, complexity.
Yeah.
And that's an exciting piece of fruit.
Yes, I think so.
That's the standard for me anyway.
Yes.
The other thing is size. Now, I just started buying, we see it this time of year, the crab apples, the little guys. Mm. And there's one that is in the market now, it's called chestnut crab apple.
Oh, yes.
These little apples, which I always associated with pickling or making, some sort of condiment out of, I started tasting them. They are sensational. And this little apple, crab apple, is the perfect size for me to slice into a salad. Mm-hmm. Or to just munch on. Is there a future now with smaller apples?
Yes. We have this whole genetic range of sizes. And I think, of course, when apples were originally in the wild, they were quite small. They were really meant to feed animals more than us. And as we've developed apples and bred them and developed new varieties, we've tended to make them bigger just so that they're more showy. But there is a limit to that idea. And in fact, I think in apples in particular, the big apple looks nice, maybe in the grocery shelf or maybe sitting in front of you on the table, but it's hard to eat an apple the size of a softball. So we are not looking for bigger. We're happy to have a whole range of apples. And in fact, a couple of the ones that I brought with me are fairly small. The tennis ball size and smaller really is an easy apple to fit in your hand. It fits your mouth size. You can always finish it. And my theory is if it's not enough, have a second one.
So are we going to see more? We're going to see more little apples?
Well, I don't know that it's an emerging trend, but let's say that the small ones are not going away completely.
Are apples getting sweeter?
Well, I think the trend as apples are eaten by larger groups of people, there is more interest in sweeter apples. So I wouldn't say that we're making them sweeter, but we're certainly, we have a wider range. Still, we see that people, even geographically in the U.S. and Northern Europe, tend to like a little more acidity with their apples. It has to be a balance.
A sweet acid balance.
Yeah. And that's the classic apple flavor is sweet and tart. But now as we see apples being eaten in more populations, and I say as we get closer to the equator, there's less tolerance or interest in acid. So we have to have a whole range of apples.
So are my favorite tart pie apples, the crispy ones, are they going to kind of be ebbing, going away?
Well, I think there'll always be a market for them, and I hope we never get back to the point of Red Delicious I'm sorry I keep going back to my old nemesis, but where we have one apple that tries to keep everybody happy.
It's the blandest.
Happy.
I mean, it's unfortunate. It really is.
Yeah.
Because there was a time when that was all we could get.
That's right, But I have to, as part of my job, taste about 500 apples a day, and we're looking for the newest and best things in our breeding program. But the two most important characteristics that we're always looking for are texture and flavor.
David, fascinating. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to have a chance to share some of the work that we're doing in the world of apple breeding with you.
David Bedford is Senior Research Fellow at the University of Minnesota's Horticultural Research Center. And that new apple with the two names, The Rave or First Kiss, well, that's going to be available nationwide sometime next year. Now, you can listen to my extended conversation with David, which includes an apple tasting, by the way. Just head to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our collection of apple recipes. All neatly packaged just for you. And you'll also find that collection of apple recipes, along with their pretty pictures, on our Pinterest page. We recently got an email from a listener asking if we could come up with a list of indestructible ingredients that would be good for a beginning cook. Well, the timing turned out to be perfect because we were checking in for our monthly lesson on cooking fundamentals with Molly Birnbaum. Now, Molly is the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, brings us the lesson.
Hey, Molly, nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So what's on your mind today? What have you guys been working on?
Mushrooms are on my mind today. They are incredibly fascinating because mushrooms are neither plant nor animal. They belong to a totally different kingdom of organisms called fungi, which also contains yeasts and molds. And unlike plants, mushrooms don't produce chlorophyll for the conversion of sunlight into energy. They instead rely on decomposed organic material as a source of nutrients, which is exactly why they grow on the forest floor.
Hmm.
It's interesting. There are around 1,000 varieties of edible mushrooms out there in the world, and only about 20 that are commercially cultivated. So when you go to the market, you really are only seeing a small number of the mushrooms that exist in the world.
That's a smidgen.
A tiny smidgen.
And what's the best way for us to store them at home?
I like to make sure that they're completely dry. So I think mm-hmm. then when mushrooms are wet and you put them in the fridge, especially if they're still in a package, they have a tendency to get a little bit slimy.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, we've done some work looking at what happens to mushrooms when you keep them in the fridge for a little while, specifically white button mushrooms. Because oftentimes when you buy that package, you put it in the fridge, you don't take it out for another week, and the mushrooms, they have like some little blemishes. They don't look as pristine as they did when you bought them. And a lot of people just, you know, maybe don't use them or throw them out. But we actually found that the slightly older blemished mushrooms that you keep in the fridge for about a week are more flavorful than the ultra-fresh white button mushrooms.
Well, that is totally surprising, and what a great tip.
Yeah, we tested that ourselves in the test kitchen, sautéing a couple batches of mushrooms, one fresh and one showing signs of age. And side-by-side comparisons, the results definitely surprised us. We found that the older mushrooms had a deeper, earthier flavor and were substantially more mushroomy than the unblemished specimens.
Oh, it's fermentation at work again, right?
Right.
So you know those recipes that tell you to wipe the mushroom with a damp paper towel or a brush? What is the right way to clean a mushroom?
That is an excellent question. I mean, some people say never wash mushrooms. Exactly, just wipe them off. And it's good to think about the fact that mushrooms grow in damp forests where it rains all the time. So it is not a bad thing to wash mushrooms at all. You just really want to be careful not to overdo it, because at some point they can soak up the water and become soggy. But they are covered in water-repelling proteins called hydrophobins. So they're not going to soak up water if you dunk them really quickly in a tub of water, for sure.
Give them a little swish and you're done. Thank you for that. That was worth talking
welcome.
To you just for that very piece of information. Okay, so let's talk about cooking them. What is it that we need to know about them to make the most of them?
Mushrooms are often referred to as the meat of the vegetable world, you know, portobello burgers, etc. Mm-hmm. And that's for a good reason. Cell walls in plants are made from something called cellulose, and the membranes in animal cells contain proteins. The cell walls of mushrooms are made from something called chitin, which is a polymer composed of a nitrogen-containing sugar. And that's important because chitin is chemically related to both cellulose and proteins. And so in that sense, it bridges the gap between plants and animals, which is super interesting. Chitin is actually the same material that is found in the shells of crustaceans like lobsters and shrimp.
Wow, that is so surprising.
Right? The first time I heard that, I had a hard time believing it. Of course, it's mixed with other things in those hard shells, but it is essentially the same material. And what is most important when it comes to cooking is that chitin is very heat stable. And so that means that when you cook mushrooms, they're not going to get super soft and mushy. They're going to retain their firm and chewy texture.
Wow. So they're actually a great ingredient for a rookie cook to take on, because it sounds like you can cook them to death and they'll never die.
It's true. We did an experiment in the test kitchen with my colleague Dan Souza to kind of show exactly that about mushrooms, that you can't overcook them. And what we did is we took portobello mushroom, beef tenderloin, and zucchini. We cut it up into the same size pieces, and then we took a Dutch oven, a little bit of water, brought it to a boil, put a steamer basket in there, and then put those three samples in the steamer basket, covered it, and started to cook them. And so every 5 minutes, we took out the samples, and we tested them in a machine we have called a texture analyzer, which measures the force that it takes to compress each thing. So you really get data on how tough something is or how soft something is.
Mm-hmm.
So what we found is that After 5 minutes of cooking, the tenderloin started to get a little bit tender. The mushroom as well got a little bit more tender. The zucchini got even a little bit more tender. But after every 5 minutes thereafter, for 40 minutes of cooking totally, they all changed pretty drastically except for the mushrooms. The tenderloin got incredibly tough. In the end, we calculated it became 293% tougher.
Wow.
Whereas the zucchini got incredibly soft. I mean, you all know what it's like to eat a totally overcooked zucchini. Right. Got very mushy. It was 83% softer. Huh. But the mushroom stayed pretty much the same. It got a little bit tougher, but just 57% tougher, which in the scheme of all this stuff is not much at all. It was good at the end of the 40 minutes of cooking. You can't overcook it.
Molly, this is great information. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Molly Birnbaum is the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, Molly left us with a recipe for stuffed portobellos that you're going to find, well, I think you know by now, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, be sure to register for this month's cookbook giveaway. This month, one registration gives you a shot at two cookbooks. Marcus Samuelson's The Red Rooster Cookbook and Anthony Bourdain's Appetites, a Cookbook. Good luck, guys. Coming up, pop-up dinners where social justice is on the menu, and how a Juilliard-trained percussionist traded the big city for a farm in northern Minnesota. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Jollof rice, goat pepper stew, fresh okra and cassava balls, fried guinea fowl. These are just some of the traditional Nigerian dishes prepared by Chef Tunde Wey. Now, he's from Lagos, Nigeria's largest city, and he's obsessed with his home country's food. 2 years ago, we began hosting pop-up dinners across the country as a way to stay connected to his roots while introducing people to the flavors he loves. Blackness in America, as he now calls the dinner series, evolved from a celebration of his native cuisine to a place for getting real about social issues. He wants people to get uncomfortable and to see the ways that food and restaurants, which are so often operated entirely by immigrants and minorities, also have links to racial justice issues. Well, Splendid Table contributor Von Diaz talked to Tunde Wey about how these dinners came to be and what he hopes to achieve by creating a space where food and conversations about racism are shared at the same table.
Tunde, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tunde, you were picked up by immigration enforcement some years ago. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, 2015 January, I was heading to Los Angeles for dinner. At that time, I was traveling to different cities and cooking Nigerian food, so that was just going to be one of my stops. And I was taking the Greyhound bus in New Mexico. There was an immigration checkpoint, and so they stopped the bus, and the Border Patrol fella came on the bus and started asking people for their papers. So that was, and he asked me if I was an American, and I said no. And then I was detained.
For how long?
About 20 days.
Ultimately, your family helped you get out of detention, right?
Yes, yes. Everybody rallied.
Yeah, thankfully. And then you went back to cooking.
Yes.
So you were doing these pop-up Nigerian dinners all over the country when you were detained. You end up in New Orleans, and then it seems like the goal of your pop-ups shifted. Can you tell me how you started doing the Blackness in America dinners?
Yeah, I wish like I knew the moment, but I don't. I had always, you know, felt it necessary, I don't know why, to separate my, you know, my like overt political position and feelings from my work. Because, you know, I just like to have a good time. Like, I just want to cook and then drink and then, like, you know, enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like my work. But in my like non-work life, my non-cooking life, as with most other people, like, I am concerned and interested in like politics and social justice and just thinking. This was the time when the reports of black folks being killed by police, you know, was sort of like reaching a crescendo. I mean, still at a crescendo right now, sort of a sustained crescendo. But yeah, so all of this was happening around that time. And then there was just a general awareness or like a shift in the national conversation around the issues of identity and race and blackness. And I was responding to that. I mean, I felt like when I started cooking, my work was to, I guess, prick and challenge like dominant food culture. And that quickly became frivolous in the face of what this food culture represents, which is a larger system of power, you know?
Yeah. Tell me about your dinners. What are they like?
So basically, it's a conversation between myself and like a special guest. And that special guest is black, and they live in the city where the dinner is being held. So we're having this conversation over a meal with other diners, and then this conversation expands to include everybody. And so we talk about quote-unquote blackness.
So who comes to these dinners?
Mostly people come to these dinners, human beings. yeah, I think it's, you know, people who are interested in talking about this. And, you know, so if you're looking, like, if it's a demographic profile, what I do is I make the room majority black. And in some cases, this funny term, it's a majority minority room or something like that, right? So it's, mm-hmm. you know, mostly people of color.
Okay. And it's what America. What do you typically serve?
Nigerian food exclusively. So, I mean, the menu. So stuff like jollof rice, fried plantains, moi moi, which is steamed bean cakes, stewed vegetables like egusi, which is ground melon seed stew.
Sounds delicious.
Cow foot stew. Yeah, it's really good.
So what do you want from the dinner?
Wow. Well, I want many things from the dinner. What I want is, I think what everybody wants is for discrimination to stop and racism to end. But personally, I don't think that is possible, at least not in my lifetime. You know, so I think that it's important not to conflate action with solution, because it implies that somehow this like 400-year-old problem or longer is solvable, you know, with a couple of administrative strokes, and that's not true. So the dinner is an action, you know. More and more, as I do more of these dinners, I want to, you know, connect the action that happens in the room to action that happens on the ground, and see how we could create more tangible responses to things that are happening in those communities. But those are parallel actions that need to happen. But you know, we also need a space to sort of like accommodate the reality that this problem isn't quite solvable, at least not in the framework that we understand solutions, because a lot of times solutions just masquerade an inability to be uncomfortable. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I guess I just want people to be happy and not be discriminated against, especially black folks. But I don't, I mean, the dinner obviously doesn't do that because, you know, there's no one thing that can do that. But the aspiration for the dinner is that.
Absolutely. Tunde, thank you so much for being here. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very much.
Chef Tunde Wei is a writer and cook based in Detroit and New Orleans. Von Diaz is a food writer and radio producer at StoryCorps. For more information on Tunde's restaurant projects, head to our website, splendidtable.org, and make sure to follow our comings and goings on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our contributor, food writer David Leet, is with us. David, who's on the agenda this week?
Molly Ye. And Molly Ye is a fascinating individual. She has a blog called My Name is Ye. She loves this idea of mixing cultures, mixing food. She's the most egalitarian, most democratic cook I think I know.
And she took an unexpected turn, right?
Yes. Yes, she started out as a Juilliard-trained timpanist. And suddenly she got into food through one of her instructors. The next thing you know, she dropped her mallets and picked up a skillet. And she married Egg Boy, her husband Nick. And they went up to Minnesota, the northern part of Minnesota, where his family has a sugar beet farm. So she spends her days sugar beeting. And in between all of that, she's baking cakes and pies and hot pots and all these wonderful dishes. And I'm sure she's entertaining her local town with her music and that vivacious laugh of hers.
It sounds so interesting. Let's have a listen.
Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's great to see you again.
It's great to see you.
I want to start off by talking about this journey that you have taken. You started out as a Juilliard-trained timpanist living in New York, and now you are the farm wife married to Egg Boy on his family's farm, raises sugar beets all the way out there in Minnesota. How does one go from there to here?
Well, I didn't mean for it to happen. I did not wake up one day and say, oh, I think I'd like to move out to a sugar beet farm in Minnesota. It just all happened organically. Mm-hmm. I met my husband at Juilliard. He's a trombonist. Mm-hmm. And after a few years of just really going hard in the city and taking advantage of everything that the city has to offer, I was really just ready to be back in the Midwest where I'm originally from.
Right.
And around that time, when we were ready to leave New York, Nick's dad, he said, well, you know, what should I plan for with the future of the farm? Should we make arrangements so that even if you don't come back and farm, the farm will stay in the family? Or are you going to come back? Because if you're going to come back, the time is now to do it. And so we went to go visit, and I loved it. I loved how flat the land was and how open the skies were. And I told Nick, I said, well, I'm coming to move back here whether you're with me or not.
So when did your journey snake away from music and into food? That happened in New York.
Yeah, that also happened just very naturally as well. I was studying at Juilliard, and one of my teachers, his name is Gordon Gottlieb, mm-hmm. he is super into food, and he would come to my lessons with stories. He's part of, you know, the Gastronauts?
Mm-hmm.
He's
mm-hmm.
part of the Gastronauts, and he would tell me about the civet cat coffee that he had just had, which is made from the beans that the cats poop out.
Right.
And he'd tell me about Momofuku Ko and how difficult it was to get a reservation, and about the Minetta Tavern Black Label Burger and all these things. And so after my snare drum lessons, I would just take all my work study money, go downtown and buy a Minetta Tavern Black Label Burger and really just get to know the restaurant scene in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also around that time that blogs started becoming more popular, and I've always kept a diary. And so I just, the blog was just a very natural transition for me just to bring my diary to the internet mm-hmm. and be able to add pictures to it.
Now, with the cookbook, which is beautiful, Molly on the Range.
Thank you.
It's got a very interesting structure with essays and recipes and these deeply personal accounts of your life. And of course, it's kind of, it's a very, I'd say, democratic book. It blends a lot of different cultures, a lot of different kinds of food. It's not highbrow, lowbrow. It just, it's all brow. So talk a little bit about how you got the idea to use some of the flow charts, for instance, for mac and cheese or the Venn diagrams for magic sesame sauce. I just think that it breaks every rule of cookbook cookery or cookbook cookbookery, yet it really works.
Well, yeah, it's how I cook, though. It's how I think about things. I look at my pantry and I see, like, you know, what do I have? What sorts of equations can I follow in order to get a risotto or to get a macaroni and cheese that's using what I have in my pantry? My mom was the type of mom that never let me have coloring books with lines. I always had blank pages and I had to draw my own pictures.
Right.
So I'm, you know, really used to not having any sort of training wheels on and not really feeling like I have to stick to one traditional format. I just want to have fun with it. And I hope that people have fun with the recipes.
I think they will. And now let's talk about a section in the book called Snacks and Celebration.
Okay.
Okay. There are some unusual dishes in there. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
Right? And such as Jerusalem bagel dogs and Asian scotch eggs and then fried cheesy pickles. Where did the inspirations for these kind of foods, these kind of blendings come from? And then really take me through the cheesy, the fried cheesy pickles. Because when I looked at that, I thought, I have to make this damn recipe.
They're so good. And be careful when you make it. Like, invite your friends over so that you don't eat them all, because that will happen if you're not careful. But, you know, it's all different sources of inspiration. The fried cheesy pickles, that is like the quintessential late night food in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. You go to the Toasted Frog, you get a gin and tonic, and you get fried cheesy pickles. And I looked at them and I said, oh my gosh, these would be so much fun to make. It's just egg roll wrappers and cheese and pickles, and you dip it in sriracha ranch. And it's so simple, but it's so good. And the Asian scotch eggs were actually inspired by a restaurant in Boston called Myers and Chang. Mm-hmm. And it's brilliant. It's just pot sticker filling around a soft boiled egg and fried. Like, you can't really go wrong
with that.
Not at all. So the inspiration for these really just comes from traveling, from keeping my eyes out to finding things on menus that are a little bit quirky and different and that maybe I could recreate at home, because at home, I'm kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and I can't really get pizza deliveries, so I'm really forced to make everything myself. Yeah.
I love the egalitarian quality of your book. I really do.
Thank you.
I think it's wonderful. Molly, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Molly Yeh is author of Molly on the Range, Recipes and Stories from an Unlikely Life on a Farm, and creator of the very popular blog, My Name is Yeh. David Leet is publisher of leetsculinaria.com. Now find Molly's recipes for fried cheesy pickles and Asian scotch eggs. They're going to be on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, I talk to you and rediscovering lost flavors. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Why don't you talk to me? It is time to turn to your calls. The lines are open. I'm standing by, ready to tackle culinary questions. So pick up your phone and call me, 800-537-5252. Right now, Teresa is calling from Boulder, Colorado. Teresa, is it a gorgeous day in Boulder?
Oh my gosh, it's so beautiful.
I can't tell you. I love your town.
Oh, it's the best. I love it here.
So I gather you called with maybe something you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, my husband and I are pescatarians, so vegetarians will eat fish.
Okay.
So I cook salmon, but I feel like I cook salmon too much. And I don't really know how to cook other types of fish.
Ah, okay.
And also, I'm wondering, like, when I go and look online for recipes, if I say pescatarian, everything has fish in it, which it's not that I don't want fish, but sometimes you just can't eat more fish, you know?
Oh, I understand. Yeah, yeah. Too much of anything is too much.
Yeah. So do you have any advice on easy fish recipes to cook that aren't salmon or places to look for recipes?
Well, first of all, I think you want to look for recipes on sites where you know there's testing. If you look for recipes on the magazine websites like the America's Test Kitchen publications, Bon Appetit, Food and Wine, Savour, these are people who are testing recipes and you know they're going to work.
Okay.
Epicurious is a good place to look because a lot of the recipes on Epicurious are coming from those sources. And the New York Times is another place. The Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Post. Those are all sites that are going to have really reliable recipes. Now, essentially, the trick with fish is you don't want to overcook it. And generally, generally speaking, if it's a fillet, you want to sear it over really high heat. You know, quickly, one side, then the other. And then you want to cook it very slowly because the slower you cook any animal protein, the juicier and tenderer it's going to be.
Ooh.
And yeah, and the idea is that you want to cook fish so that when you make a little cut into it, you see that the color has gone or the – let me back up. If you cut into a raw fillet – or a raw fish, you'll see the flesh looks like if you were to slice it thin, you could see through it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Now, when it's all solid colored, be it white or pink, it's done. Okay? Now, you may even want to take it that a little before that because it continues cooking after you take it off the heat. You see?
Yeah. And when is the best part to season it? Like, should I marinate it?
When you marinate, you can marinate it any way you want, depending on the fish, because some fish are very delicate. Some fish can stand up to, you know, really powerful marinades. Some want very simple marinades. But the idea is never more than about a half hour and always in the refrigerator.
Okay.
Okay? Now, let's talk about the kind of fish that are out there.
Okay.
Trout. You're in trout territory, and trout is sweet as can be. And with trout, often what you do instead of fillets, you cook the trout whole, okay? You know, and it's...
I get scared.
No, don't get scared. Don't get scared. Because once it's done, all right, and one way I love to cook it, by the way, is I take a bunch of herbs and I spread them in a shallow pan. Okay, with some onion and garlic, and then I put the trout in the pan, spacing out a couple of them, so they're maybe a couple of inches apart, and I sprinkle everything with salt and pepper, and I sprinkle olive oil over the trout, okay? And then I put it in something like a 300-degree oven until when I make a little cut in the side of the trout. You know, that you see that solid white, and you pull it out and you very gently with two spatulas lift the trout out, sprinkle lemon juice on it, and then you can just peel back the skin very easily. And you peel back the skin, you eat that little fillet, and then you can flip it over and peel back the skin or just lift out the bones. You have to be careful because there's a lot of small bones, but it's really good. Now, that technique works with other small whole fish.
Okay.
Just remember, and when you're buying a whole fish, if it has the head on, you can tell how fresh it is because the eye should be clear and bulging. That's the sign of a really fresh fish.
Okay.
So you want to always watch the timing. Some people say 10 minutes to the inch of thickness.
Okay.
I test it at 8.
Okay.
But tilapia, cod, haddock, halibut, These are all rather delicate fish, you know, very mild tasting. There's sole, which is a flat fish, and the fillets are very thin, so you can cook them very quickly. And all of these fish are delicious, and every one of them has a slightly different flavor.
Awesome.
Okay. We're not even talking shellfish yet. That's for call number two. Okay. All right.
I'll get some practicing in the meantime.
Yeah. Hey, thanks so much, Teresa, and enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
Stephen is calling from Washington, D.C. Stephen, what do you want to talk about? What's up?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
You are welcome.
Oh, I'm excited. My wife and I traveled to France recently, and like a lot of people, we were impressed with the food, but one of the real surprises in Normandy was how good the butter was.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
You're talking butter central.
Yeah, it was terrific. And so we asked at the hotel that we stayed at, or the restaurant at the hotel, and they mentioned that the butter they used was from Isny-Saint-Mare. Excuse my pronunciation.
Yeah, I don't know. I know. Right. Yeah, right.
And then when we got back to the States, we asked at our Whole Foods, and they said that they get a special shipment just once a year. And so it came in, and I went a little overboard, and I bought a kilo of it.
That's 2 pounds.
That's
yes.
Right. A little over. And so I've been using it to saute vegetables and to finish a steak. Mm. But I really wanted to ask you, how can I get a recipe that makes butter the star of the show?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I have to think for a moment. Well, the first thing that you can do with the butter is poach in butter.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean,
like
you
a
can.
Fish?
Well, whitefish, people do lobster tails in butter.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, scallops. These are things that by nature have a certain sweetness and a delicacy to them. You see, you know where I'm going? And you could do, you could do certainly a whitefish. You could do, salmon's too fatty. You want something that's not super fatty because you don't want to taste the fish fat. You want to have the fish that's been gently cooked in that butter. Another thing that you can do, you know, there's an Italian classic dish that's done with milk, but doing it in butter, where you slow roast a pork roast, and you could do it with like, about a half a pound of butter that you keep spooning over it. And when the pork fat mixes with that delicious butter, and maybe you have a little garlic in there, perhaps, or a little onion or shallot, that is one of the great moments in life.
And sounds terrific.
Now, another way to go is to do literally a sweet butter where you gently melt that butter with caramelized sugar in a skillet. So first you put sugar in a skillet with a little bit of water and you melt it over medium to medium-low heat, very slowly. And when it gets to be barely looking like caramel, that's when you add the butter. And you stir it a bit, and then it melts. It's just barely melted. It's like cream. And then you can put that over something really neutral, like a pound cake or even a waffle. It would be so it would be so wonderful. A little vanilla would pick it up too. It would be very, very nice. So that's a couple of ideas, and just eat it.
Yeah. Well, great. So I'll try the pork and then the butter with the sugar over a waffle or something.
Right. And think about the poaching in the butter. You could also poach chicken breasts in it, which would be delicious. Mm. And then you'll go on a diet. Let us know. I hope no cardiologists are listening.
That's right. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, I'm envying you no end. Thank you, Stephen. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, if you've never butter poached, we have got a butter poaching recipe from Michael Ruhlman. He did butter poached shrimp with grits. Can't beat it. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And you can call us, 800-537-5252. The word artisan is so overused today that it's become practically meaningless. I mean, we can now get artisanal sandwiches from fast food chains, for goodness sakes. And yet, real artisans, the people who are crafting things like cheese, beer, bread, coffee, chocolate, and bourbon, just to name a few, well, they're experiencing a resurgence like never before. And that's the paradox that fascinated Patrick Q when he began work on his new book, Finding the Flavors We Lost. Our contributor, Russ Parsons, talked to Patrick in Los Angeles.
Patrick Q, thank you so much for being on Splendid Table with us.
Pleasure to be here, Russ.
I want to talk to you about your book, Finding the Flavors We Lost. And the title begs the first question, which is, how did we lose those flavors in the first place?
Yeah, key question. We did eat very well, and then suddenly we were all eating five-can casserole in 1955. How did that happen? Many factors. Speed of transportation, a growing amount of food preservation, but on an industrial scale. Brand awareness, very savvy marketing by large brands that brands were very savvy of establishing this idea of purity. And the idea of purity came from brands, and brands were in sealed boxes. And there are all sorts of loyalty programs of, you know, if you sent the wrapper into the home office. And then the very idea of modernity, you know, there was this sense of, wow, all this cooking and all this putting up vegetables took a lot of time. And the idea sort of was promoted that you didn't want to be tied to these, long tasks. And in fact, if you were a modern woman, you would resist being tied and you would reject it all. So all this sort of conspired to drain the vitality and the characteristics from American food.
We tend to forget these days. I mean, cooking is work. I mean, for those of us who love it, it's also a pleasure, but right. But traditional cooking is a lot of work, and to be freed from that work must have been liberating. But now we're kind of going back in the opposite direction, except now we're calling it artisanal rather than work. So what does artisanal actually mean?
Well, the idea of work is certainly key to it. And of course, Russ, you know, it's abused and misused and used as a marketing term so often that one almost shies from using it. I think there's an element of time. Is this somebody who's allowing the maximum of flavor to develop, whether it's the 24 hours for a naturally leavened bread, the 8 months for Swiss-style cheese, the years for great bourbon? Secondly, the idea of craft, the skill that the hands learn. And can that be maintained in the way we eat today? I think a third aspect of this is the intentionality of something. And it's kind of abstract, but there's just a way that artisans approach things that industrialized commercial food does not. And lastly, does it speak to our heritage? Because I think that's one of the most resonant aspects of artisanal is it's picking up on something, whether it's home preserving and home canning, or you go to the trouble of curing bacon, you go to the trouble of making a vinegar. Cider vinegars were being used a couple of hundred years ago, and you're sort of picking up the thread that was dropped. And that has a sort of resonance to me of what artisanal food is.
One of the great controversies at this point is that question of scale. I mean, you make a great product. You get really good at it. You find you can start to make more. The money starts to come in. You can actually pay your workers more. But all of a sudden, you're no longer that indie band that everybody loved when they were when they were playing in 200-seat clubs.
Right.
All of a sudden, you've become big business. How do you balance the intentionality and the proficiency that's required of being a craftsman with the ability to grow and to get your products to more people and at a more efficient price?
Yeah. We have to get away from this idea that only small is good. Only small is authentic. Think of the language. Small scale, microbrewery, nanobrewery. It's all reducing it to tiny amounts. Long before it meant small, it meant independence, being able to navigate the world as an independent being. These people should not be trapped in this kind of fallacy of small is better, because artisanal is going to get bigger. And if you can maintain the standards, I think you're embodying what an artisan means, not becoming the opposite of it.
Patrick Q, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been great having you.
My pleasure, Roz.
Patrick Q is longtime restaurant critic for Los Angeles Magazine. His new book is Finding the Flavors We Lost. Contributor Russ Parsons is author of How to Pick a Peach. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought. Labels can be treacherous. For instance, when a milk manufacturer adds to his label the word real, as in real farm fresh milk, you have to wonder, what was he palming off on us before? SplendidTable.org has just about everything you'll ever need. Recipes, giveaways, and extended versions of interviews. Don't forget to check out our extended interview with Apple expert David Bedford. And by the way, we also did a tasting. And if you like what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. And for a daily dose of food inspiration, make sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.